On this show, I talk with a fellow podcaster about the challenges and rewards that he has faced since being diagnosed with a rare eye condition and what a trip to Japan taught him about his abilities. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And for those of you who are living in Japan, how did you enjoy being woken up at 2 o'clock in the morning last night from that earthquake alarm? Oh man, I hate that thing. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, is that here in Japan, obviously they have a lot of earthquakes, and they have this system in place that can kind of sense when an earthquake's coming, and it sends a warning to your phone. I'm not sure exactly how it works. I think it has sensors out in the ocean or somewhere, and when it senses some seismic activity, it sends a warning to everybody's phone. Now, obviously, no one knows when an earthquake is going to happen, so you don't know when, you know, this is going to go off. But it really scares the crap out of you because it's totally unexpected. And this is what it sounds like. Now, I realize that doesn't sound very scary, but it's actually much louder than that. And imagine, like, you're sitting there either at home watching TV, eating dinner, you know, even sleeping or whatever, and suddenly your phone just starts screeching away with this warning. And I swear, it is many times it's more scary than the actual earthquake. If it was that big-ass earthquake that they had in 2011, yeah, that'd be scary. But the last two ones are, like, literally felt like, you know, someone, like, giving you a massage in bed or something. It just kind of, like, rolls you around a little bit and then, like, eh, woke me up for that. And the funny thing is, I have two phones. I have a Japanese phone and a Canadian iPhone. So I have two phones here, so they both go off. And last night it was 2 in the morning, and God, did it freak me out. That's 2 days in a row now we've had the earthquake alarm go off, and so... Oh man, yesterday's earthquake was actually bigger than the day before. The one day before was like hardly nothing. I was like, what? You woke me up for this? Last night, it went off about 2, and like I could feel like my apartment shaking for quite some time, but I just literally went back to sleep. Like, I don't dive undercover or anything like that. I'm just like, eh, go back to sleep, but God, that thing scares the crap out of me. On today's show, I'm going to be talking with a fellow podcaster who had a very unique experience when he came to Japan. Now, you can imagine that a lot of people, when they come to Japan for the first time, it's probably a bit of a confusing and intimidating experience, especially if they've never been in an Asian country or an Asian city before or a big city. You know, you got the, you know, tons of people everywhere, train lines going which way, super busy city, confusing language. So your first day in Tokyo can be kind of a confusing experience. Now imagine having to do all of that without having the ability to see what's going on around you. And that's exactly the situation that my guest today faced in. His name is Tony Vega, and he is a podcaster from Hawaii. And he has a condition called Leber's Hereditary Optic Neuropathy. God, that's a hard word to say, neuropathy. Which is basically a condition, as I understand it, that reduces the optic nerve connection between your eye and your brain. So what happens is, over time, the amount of vision that he has available to him will actually decrease. And it actually decreases at quite a surprisingly fast rate.
It happened over the course of maybe like 3 to 4 months. I went from totally no glasses. I was driving in late, like right at the end of my senior year of high school, to not being able to drive, not being able to read any normal size text, and having to use like technology and things to find new ways to do things.
So when it comes to blindness, I think a lot of sighted people tend to think of it as an all or nothing thing. You know, when we see someone walk around with that white cane, we tend to think that they can't see anything. But the reality is, when it comes to blindness, there's a lot of variations to it as to what people can and cannot see. So I asked Tony to tell me exactly what it is that he can see.
If I were to put it in a very clear way of a picture that everybody could understand, it's like a donut where I can't see anything where the hole would be of the donut, but I can see kind of the right, left, and bottom. The top I can't see so much, but yeah, that kind of bottom crescent sort of area.
What the parts that you can see, mm-hmm. Is it clear? Is it like what you could see before, or is it different?
It's tough to say, because the thing about your peripheral vision, or, you know, the bottom area of your vision, because that's not the area that you really focus when you're reading, right? Like, I can't really say for sure if it's the same or not, but I can see, I have some problem seeing some colors, especially if they're similar, they kind of blend together. And high contrast things are generally far easier to see. So even in the areas where I can still see, it's not like I'm still seeing like I used to. It's diminished, right? Compared to the central area, which is really the most usable area that people normally would use.
I think this is one of the things that maybe sighted people have struggle to understand, because mm-hmm. when someone tells me, like my friend tells me that she can only see like in the center, mm-hmm. it's easy for me just to hold up a toilet paper roll to my eye and going, well, I mean, yeah, that's kind of limited, but I can still see. But the reality is even what she sees in the center is not what I see in the center.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So it's quite varied. And so the interesting thing, when I was researching mm-hmm. what you have is that it happened to you pretty quickly, didn't it?
Yeah. I think the beginning part was the fastest part, and then it probably kept going for some months later, but it seemed like it was much slower. So it started like a couple months before I graduated high school, and then by that summer I just, like I said, I couldn't drive. I was declared legally blind, and then just a couple months after that I started at my university. So it was a very, very fast transition, and the transition of getting used to this new way of doing things, a new way of living, was far longer than just those few months.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. So you went from having no vision issues at all mm-hmm. To literally a couple of months later, you're declared legally blind. Like, that's a pretty fast transition.
Yeah.
What was some of the early symptoms that you had?
So like I said, this condition is quite rare. And even the first eye doctor that I went to, they didn't spot it right away. They told me, oh, it's stress, it's psychosomatic. Basically, like, it's in your head, don't worry about it, just relax and it'll go away. And what originally presented was a spot, kind of like a very small speck in my right eye, almost like when you look at a bright light and then you close your eyes and you have like that kind of leftover something there for a few seconds. But except in my case, it didn't go away. And then it grew almost like imperceptibly for probably a week or two. I didn't really notice it. But after a while, I started to notice that it was getting bigger. And so it got to the point where I thought, okay, I should start going to a doctor and see what's going on. And then they gave me glasses. The glasses didn't really do anything because it just kept getting worse. And I think it was by the time I saw the third doctor, which was a specialist, a neuro-ophthalmologist, that finally he was able to identify what it was. So it was a relatively slow transition, but in the big picture, when you go from like basically totally normal vision to, you know, not being able to do most of the things that we all take for granted, you know, within a few months, I mean, that does sound quite quick.
Yeah, that sounds crazy fast. Yeah. Was there anything that could be done to slow it down?
I don't...
Eating carrots, for example?
So see, that's the thing. So whenever I discuss this with anyone, you know, one of the very first questions that I get is like, can you use glasses, right? And it's like, no, because the thing is that it's part of the optic nerve. So the nerve dies. This is my understanding. I'm not a doctor, but this is just what I've, you know, read and what I've heard. But, you know, part of the optic nerve dies. And, you know, nerve regeneration is this very big deal in medical science. That's something that would help tons and tons of people beyond just me. But it's something that we are not quite there yet, right? We're not there yet. So in the process, when this is happening, you know, I remember reading something about like, what are those called? Like hyperbaric chambers or something like that. Like there's kind of sketchy, like not quite super, you know, kind of, what would you call it? Like anecdotal,
like
kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right.
You know, and vitamins, and I still take vitamins to this day, you know, and basically stay healthy. You know, they say triggers could be like tobacco and alcohol, things like that, but it's all not 100%, you know, it's just basically stay healthy to try to keep yourself healthy overall. And that will help maintain, you know, what you have left. But there's no solid, you know, kind of silver bullet thing that says if you do this early enough, it will stop. Right.
Right. But it's understandable that you would try anything, right?
Absolutely.
Like if doctor said eat carrots, I'd eat buckets of carrots.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course.
Orange,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. No, and like I said, I started taking vitamins very early because there's some kind of indication that, for example, things like coenzyme Q10 and things like that, they can help with some of the things that are related to this. So, and I still do, just, you know, there's nothing wrong with vitamins. So why not?
Right. Yeah. So I'm curious. I'm always curious, actually, when people are faced with these kind of situations that are totally beyond their control, mm-hmm. how do they handle it mentally?
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, that's the only thing you can do, right?
Yep.
The only thing you can
Absolutely.
Control at that point is your reaction to the situation, which is a hell of a lot easier said than done.
Yes. Yes.
So when you finally got the diagnosis and you kind of recognized what was going to happen, what was your response?
It was very strange. I accepted it, but it was kind of like a sense of just giving up. It's like, okay, this is my situation and I just got to go on with it. But it wasn't an optimistic kind of acceptance. It was just like, okay, I got this bad situation and that's my life. Oh, well, woe is me kind of thing. Right.
Right.
And
so I guess you saw like no positives at all.
No, not at all.
In the situation.
No. I mean, I didn't decide to, for example, like, okay, I'm not going to go to college, you know, like I think that was probably like a month or two before classes were set to start. I didn't decide that. I just decided, all right, I'm just going to go and keep on doing what I'm doing. But it's not like I was, you know, happy about the situation or that I saw, like, I didn't think the situation was better for me or that more doors had opened up. On the contrary,
right.
Like things didn't look good.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's an understandable reaction, I guess, you know. But I imagine then at some point you started to kind of change your thinking as to at least the potential that was available to you,
yeah.
right?
So, I mean, there's multiple factors, but one big factor really ended up being my interest in Japan, my interest in the Japanese language. You know, I had been interested in Japan and learning Japanese for years and years since I was, you know, pretty young. But when I was in high school, a friend of mine, again, a classmate that I had known for probably 4 or 5 years by the time that he did this, he went on a study abroad program. And I had really wanted to do this. And this was when I could still see. But I didn't do it. You know, I always thought there's always tomorrow, whatever. I don't have to do it now. And then when we were in university, he ended up going to Japan again. And I had told him, like, next time you go, I would love to go with you. And by then I couldn't see. So I was in the mentality that I would not be able to go by myself. So I would have to go with someone. So if anybody's going to go, it's going to be him. And I would tag along with him. So that was probably like 2005, I think. And he decided to go. And then he told me. And at first I said yes, but then I ended up chickening out. I was just not comfortable with myself and still in that mentality of not comfortable or confident in what I was capable of. I thought I could do far less than I ended up being able to do. And so he ended up going with another friend and they had a good time. And then thankfully the next year he decided to go again and visit his old host family again. And at that point I decided to go and I went with him and I had a nice time. It was like 4 weeks, mainly in Kagoshima, but we also went to Tokyo and I had a wonderful time. But when I came back, I was a bit unsatisfied with my ability to communicate with people in Japan, because by that point I had studied probably like 2.5 years of Japanese in university and a bit more in high school as well. And yeah, I could understand the occasional word here or there and throw out a few words, but I couldn't have conversations. And I got to the point where I thought, like, okay, I've put so much time and effort into this. I need to either get serious about this or basically just give it up and move on to something that's more productive. So that motivated me to get more serious. And that would eventually lead into me studying abroad and going back to Japan to work and all that. And it gave me something to kind of work towards, I guess you could say.
So I guess having that kind of motivation, I suppose, gave you the confidence to try things that you may not have before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just going to Japan and seeing, okay, I was there, I enjoyed it, and I want to come back. That was one motivation. Two, you know, just knowing that if I got to a place in the language where I could explain my situation, where I could tell people like, look, actually, I can't see that well. I'm lost. Can you help me? And then understand what they were telling me. Then I would feel safe to be walking around, you know, and exploring and trying to make friends and meeting people and doing all these things, you know. But for people, you know, when they go to Japan and they don't know the language, you know, that is of course a worry. Although, you know, you can get by without knowing the language, but it's something to be, you know, think about. But when you have like an extra layer of things, like when you can't see the street signs, when you can't see that people are pointing that the bathroom is over there, when you like can't tell what number the bus is, what route the train is, you know, you have to be able to understand what people are saying, what the train announcements are saying. And so I was aware of this, and I made it a point that by the next year when I ended up studying abroad, I would be able to understand these things. And I put in the time to be able to get to a point where I could have conversations and understand what people were telling me.
Yeah, because if you don't understand the language, so much of that communication is hand signals, right? So
yeah.
If you can't see those hand signals, like you said, if someone's pointing somewhere, like you're I mean, I don't know where you're pointing, right? So you can't exactly reach out, grab their arm, and then go all the way down to their hand and like feel their finger and go, okay, I got it. You know, like,
so. And like the extra tricky thing with me is that, especially when I was living in Japan, I wasn't using a cane. So if you look at me, like you might not, a lot of times people don't figure it out right away or ever unless I actually explicitly say it. And you know, when in Japan, if that were to happen to me, the first thing they assume is, oh, not that he can't see, oh, this guy can't understand what I'm telling him,
right? Come you don't use the cane? Wouldn't it be better to use it so people know immediately?
So now I do. I live in Hawaii, and I walk around, and I've been, you know, here for 5-6 years, and I do a lot of walking. I take the bus, and it's for my own safety, but it's also just easier. Like I said, when you know you talk to somebody, they get it right away, right? Although sometimes they don't even notice. Like sometimes they don't notice that you're holding the cane. But when I was living in Japan, I felt safe because I was just getting on the trains, and I wasn't like crossing a lot of streets, and I think when I came back, after I came back from Japan from living there when I was working for 3 years, and then I decided to come to Hawaii, I was even more comfortable with my condition. And I think back then I was still a little bit kind of perhaps embarrassed about it and not quite as open as I am now about it. So that was one thing. And two, I just didn't feel like I was in danger like I am here. If I'm walking around and crossing like 10 streets to go to work, it just doesn't make sense not to use the cane, right?
When you went to Japan with your friend that first time and you came back and you realized that, you know, that there was that language barrier there and you decided to go back. You decided to go after that. You decided to go back on your own, right? You wanted to actually live and work in Japan. Is that right?
Yeah. So after the year after that, I ended up studying abroad for a year in Japan. And then another year after that, I think it was that was when I went to work in Japan for 3 years as part of the JET program.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then when you decided to do that, where was your mentality at that point? Because this time you would be coming to Japan on your own.
Yeah.
Right? So was there any fear at that point, or were you confident enough that you could handle it, or what?
No, I was absolutely uneasy. And so one of the first things I did when I decided to look into studying abroad was I talked to my Japanese teacher at the university I was at, and she was extremely helpful. And she would meet with me. She would meet with me after class. I think that semester I wasn't even taking a class with her, and she would still meet with me. And I would ask her, like, how do I say this? You know, how do I explain, you know, what's legally blind or something like that in Japanese? If I ask this question and people tells me, like, what would they tell me? What should I expect? And so, you know, like, it's not, I don't recommend learning a bunch of like phrases. That's not how you're going to get super proficient at Japanese. But my case was very specific in which I needed to know like very specific things, how to like explain things that oftentimes, even when I explain in English, people might not get right away. So, you know,
you need to know the answer, yeah, right? Because it's one thing to be able to ask the question, but if you don't understand the answer, then you're kind of screwed, right?
Exactly. So. Yeah. Exactly. So I talked to her, and then I went to the study abroad program at my university, and I explained my situation to them, and they started communicating with the school that I ended up going to. And so everybody was just very, very helpful. And one other thing that ended up happening too is I ended up meeting some students from the university that I ended up going to. And so by the time that I went that summer, I had one very good friend, and she ended up showing me around a bit when I got there. And that was just an immense relief to know that somebody was already there and that she was going to be able to show me how to get from my dorm to the school, the campus. And that was like a 20-minute walk, right? And what happens with me is I have to build a mental map, you know, I can see to some extent, but I can't see, you know, the street signs and those, some landmarks that most people would use. So sometimes I have to like remember like, oh, I have to cross five streets and then turn right. And then at that corner, I'll have to make a left. And, you know, I have to kind of build this map almost like a video game in my head. And so she was there to help me with that. And just knowing like, okay, I'm at the dorm, but now I know how to, from like basically the second day I was there, I knew how to get to the supermarket. I knew how to get to school. Those two things right there, like I'm not going to die, right? I'm good.
Yeah.
So of course I was worried, I was concerned, but I was able to kind of talk to the right people and make the right connections where at least I had a basic kind of safety net when I got there.
Yeah, I'm always surprised actually how my friend in Bangkok was able to do that. She had like a mental map of the whole city. And if you've ever been to Bangkok, Bangkok is a nightmare. It's like even for sighted people, it's chaos to walk around there.
Oh,
you know, like,
geez, yeah.
But yeah, she knew how many, like she could count the steps up to the train station. She knew where the streets were. It was just unbelievable how good she was at navigating through that city.
Yeah. And the less you can see, the better you get at it. I still have some eyesight, so I still sometimes rely on visual cues. So,
what were some of the things that kind of stood out for you in getting around Japan, say compared to in the States? Like when you're like, obviously, you know, you kind of probably went out on your own every now and then, right? So what was that like?
Yeah. Right away, I was living in Florida. You know, now I live in Hawaii, but I was in Florida for much of the time from before I first went to Japan. But as I'm sure you know, most of the U.S., like, if you don't have a car, it's very, very difficult. It's very, very frustrating. Public transportation is usually not that reliable. And that was the case in South Florida where I was. So when I became unable to drive, that was a huge frustration for me. I had wonderful friends and my parents and my mom, especially, you know, if I needed to go somewhere, they would help me. But I don't like relying on people without a choice like that. I have no problem asking people for help if I need it. But when I'm put in a corner where I have no choice but to ask for help, I feel frustrated with myself.
Yeah.
And, like that's how I felt in Florida.
Cause you lose your freedom, right? Cause you have to rely on someone else to do something for you. And
Everything depends. And like I said, thankfully I had friends, so very good friends from high school, and we would just constantly hang out. So it was always, they always just took it as a given. It's like, I'm going to go pick you up. I'm going to go pick you up. And that was never a problem, but you still have it in your head, right? Like, oh, I wish I could just go meet them,
you want your independence back is basically what it is, right?
Yeah. So, exactly. And so when I got to Japan, like, yeah, there was a little bit of a learning curve with the train and whatever, but I was in Osaka and it was just so freeing because I could walk to school And then from school, I could either take the bus or I could walk to the train station. And then I could get to the city center of Kyoto or Osaka within, I don't know, like 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And then I could meet friends there. I could tell them, you know, like, oh, I'll meet you by the turnstile, you know, and we'd meet and we'd go. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And that is one of the reasons why I wanted to go back, because I didn't want to go back to Florida, because I, even though as much as I love being with my friends and seeing them and all that, I didn't want to go back to that state where I was totally reliant on other people.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's kind of interesting, actually. I never thought about it, but like for some people to be able to live in the city without the need of a car is actually quite freeing, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's life changing. And it really, you know, like even applying for a job in Florida, like he's like, okay, how am I going to get to this place? You know,
yeah.
Everything always comes back to that. But,
yeah,
you know, when you have the train or the bus there and it's reliable, like it's just one less thing you have to worry about.
Do those dots in the ground help you here in Japan?
Yes. Yes, they do. Most of the time I'll be
here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're like lines that usually, they kind of span out from central train stations along the sidewalk, right? Like you can feel them with your foot when you're walking along them. Most of the time I'll say, no, they don't help. But every once in a while, when I would be walking around and I'd get a bit lost and I know I'm looking for a train station, and then all of a sudden those raised like things, the lines start on the sidewalk, I know, okay, I'm getting close to something important. It's probably the train station that I'm looking for. And then I could follow that. And more often than not, I'd figure out where I was.
Did you use your cane while you were here?
No. No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
So I can see well enough to kind of make it out visually. But you know, once you step on it, of course, then it's anybody will feel it. They're pretty easy to feel.
Right. I think they're called tactile pavement or something like that. I can't remember what they're called.
Yeah, in Japanese, on the train station, they call them kiroi tenji broku, yellow braille blocks. I guess is the translation.
Like, I remember once, the reason why I asked that because is, you know, I think Japan does a pretty good job of building accessibility into their cities.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I remember once I saw this blind guy in Shinjuku Station and he was hanging out at the bottom of like the stairs to go up to the platform. And there's a handrail that goes from bottom to the top and he was feeling the bottom of the rail.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he left, I was like, what's he doing? So I went over there and I felt it. And there's actually Braille at the bottom of the handrail of every platform. So you know what station, like what train line is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another, I thought, wasn't that clever?
No, I felt those too. And another wonderful thing, probably anybody that's been to Japan has noticed this, but sometimes stairwells will make noise. In Osaka, sometimes you hear like kind of jungle sort of noises, like birds and I don't know, like kind of wildlife noises, and that is to let you know that the stairwell is right there. So if I were to get off a train station or a train at the station at the platform and I'm kind of far away from the stairwell and I don't know if I should walk right or left, there are times when I could just stand there, listen, and I go, oh, okay, that bird chirping, that's where I should walk to go down the stairs.
Yeah, I really like this. There's an architectural term for it. It's escaping me right now, but I've read that a lot of architects now are starting to build cities and buildings to have this accessibility, but it's almost hidden.
Yeah.
So it's not like the old days where you have like a set of stairs and then a ramp beside it. You know, the new one would just be a ramp and it wouldn't look like it was like designed separately. It would just be part of the building.
So
same thing with Japan here. Like I like the fact that this braille on the handrails is actually on the bottom. Nobody would really notice that it was there except for the people who needed it.
Yeah.
And then with the birds chirping for the exit, to everybody else, it just sounds like birds chirping.
Yeah.
But for people who need it, it's a guide, it's a direction.
Yeah, yeah.
So this type of kind of design where it's like it's helpful, but it's not kind of in your face and it's not like a separate thing, I think is really great.
Yeah, 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 definitely. There's also like a lot of the major train stations have restrooms that make like a little ding. It's a soft ding. And oftentimes they'll even tell you, ladies is on the right side, men's is on the left side. Oh, and that's another wonderful thing because, you know, like I can see well enough where if I if I'm close enough to the sign, I can make out the shape of the, you know, figure on the thing to figure out if it's men or women. But right. if you can't see anything, you don't want to walk in the wrong one, right? But that tells you, you don't have to deal with that.
But actually, does it matter? I mean, you can't see anything. Like,
well, yeah. Cares, I mean, right? Like, for you, the blind person, it may not matter. You may not even notice, but the people in the bathroom, they'll notice.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So, one thing I'm kind of curious about, you spent what, 3 years, did you say, in Japan?
So 1 year studying and 3 years working.
Right. So 4 years in total.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that since the start of your condition, this is probably the most independent that you'd felt in a long time.
Yeah, well, living in Japan, absolutely. Yeah, whether it was studying abroad and even more so when I was working there. Yeah, just because, like, in between, I was there, I was in Florida for a year, and then that was another year of, like, oh, no, I'm stuck in at right. home and that kind of thing. So, yeah, Japan had that extra thing for me. Yes, I enjoy a lot of Japanese things. Yes, I enjoy the language and all that media and all that kind of stuff. But for me, Japan meant freedom as well.
And then, so I'm curious as to kind of what you might have learned about yourself during your time here that you took back to America with you? Because having all this freedom, I'm imagining you're going out more,
yeah,
meeting friends more, probably doing more things that you may not have necessarily done back in Florida.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that those kinds of events must have taught you something about yourself and maybe what you're capable of or what you weren't capable of. Or,
well, I think overall, you know, the time that I spent in Japan just showed me that, you know, I can still do a lot, maybe even the vast, vast majority of things that I had wanted to do that at one point after being diagnosed with this, I thought I won't be able to do. It showed me that, yeah, I can, it may take me a little bit longer. I may have to find ways to work around it. As long as I can, you know, figure out a way to get it done, I'll still accomplish it. Right. And I can still find like that same happiness and sense of satisfaction that I thought I hadn't been capable of. So after all that time, you know, I did end up going back to Florida after I finished my time with the JET program, but I didn't want to stay there. I decided that, you know, I wanted to go to graduate school, and I ended up going to Hawaii for many reasons, but one, because I had read that, you know, the bus system is quite good. The city is not so huge that you can't get around fairly easily. I walk a lot of the times. So, you know, I started thinking about how I can live the life that I want to lead. And I think that time in Japan really made me realize that that is how I should approach things rather than to like lament or anything like that.
Right, right, right. Yeah. That's really interesting because that's probably quite a different mindset than what you had when you originally were first diagnosed, right? Like you said, you kind of accepted it, but you're like, oh, well.
Yeah. No,
what can I do?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I didn't think I'd be studying abroad. I didn't think that, you know, like, okay, maybe I can go to Japan, but it'll have to be with someone. You know, I don't know. Like, there are tons of things that, you know, like, for example, like, I mean, this is something super silly, but all of a sudden I couldn't play video games anymore, right? Like, and so you start to focus on these relatively insignificant things, which, like, to me is insignificant now. Right? Because I found other things that bring me happiness.
Yeah.
But, you know, I couldn't watch Japanese like movies and anime, like, which I had been doing, like, you know, that's something that I enjoy. I couldn't really do that because my Japanese wasn't at the level where I could enjoy these things anymore. So that was another motivation. Like, I want to keep enjoying these things. I don't want to watch the dubs because it's not for me. I like to watch the original. And
yeah.
All that stuff was just pushing me like, okay, so if you want to fix this, then you just have to get better at the language, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting how that motivated you to actually get better at the language so you could end up doing what you wanted to do and enjoy it in even a better way, so to speak. Like you said, like before, if you didn't know the language, you would watch it with subtitles or dubbed, which was not the great experience.
Yeah.
Now you can enjoy it in Japanese, which is actually a better experience.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, having said that, I saw a documentary once where these blind guys were in Israel and they play video games. They play Street Fighter.
They play Street Fighter?
Yeah. And they were so good. They were so good. It was crazy. Like they from all the sound, they knew all the moves and where everybody was and whatnot.
I saw a video of Punch-Out. These guys they're not even blind, but they blindfold themselves and they figure out all the auditory cues and they can beat the whole game.
Yeah. These guys are playing Street Fighter. I was like, holy crap. It was funny too when they were playing the reporter and they're not even looking at the TV. Like they're just looking like somewhere totally off, but they're listening. It's just hilarious. So like it's a cliche to say it, but you never really know that the true human potential until you kind of push yourself, do you? Because you know, who would have thought that these blind guys would be so good at playing Street Fighter? But
they proved
us wrong, right?
When you really want to do something, you usually, if you put your mind to it, can figure out a way to get it done, even if it's like something totally out of left field, right?
And to get to that point, you need to push yourself, I guess, into as many uncomfortable situations as you can.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because you need to basically teach yourself what you're capable of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, nowadays, I really don't care. It's like, yeah, I don't know, whatever. I'm low vision. I'm legally blind. Whatever. I don't care about the term. You know, it is what it is. Here's the information. All right, now there's this thing I want to do. Can you help me?
You know? Yeah. Is there anything that you would want to tell sighted people to maybe do or think or act when they see someone who's blind or walking with a cane?
So as we were talking about already, but you know, people that have, you know, low vision or, you know, partially sighted or totally blind, you know, there's a whole range, right? So some people need more help than others. And some people that are totally blind, they can get very offended if you just grab them. You know, they are very, very, very competent people. And, you know, they don't like it when you do that, right? So if you do see a person that looks like they might need help, I think, you know, and I do this to people that see less than me, because I do interact with other people that are totally blind, and this happens, but you know, they may be a little bit lost. That happens to all of us. You know, I go, oh, do you need some help? And then they might say, yes. In that case, I go like, oh, where are you looking for? Where do you want to go to? Oh, the bathroom. Okay. The bathroom's on the right, you know, and I explain it in clear terms. I don't say over there, right? You have to be very concrete. And then at the end of that, I say, I can take you over there if you'd like, or if you're okay, you know, then, you know, I'll just leave it at that. If they say yes, then I offer, do you want to grab onto my arm? I can take you, or can you follow my voice? Can you see me well enough to follow me? Right? So I think generally, and this is from my experience interacting with other people with visual impairments, this is kind of the etiquette, because, you know, sometimes people can see more than I can, right? And they don't need that specific help. They don't need you to grab them, right? But even if they need the help, usually it's not nice to grab somebody. So, you know, if they do want you to grab them, then they'll tell you, please grab me. Right? So basically you give them that opportunity, right?
Thanks to Tony Vega for coming on the show and giving us some insight into his experience in Japan. If you want to listen to more of Tony's podcast, you can do so on his website at japankyo.com. That's japankyo.com. And I'll post a link to that in the show notes of this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. You know, I think it's a really great experience for anybody to go and try to walk around with a blind person if you can. Like, actually lead them by having them grab your elbow. Because it's really interesting how you have to suddenly pay attention to way more than what you might have originally thought. Like, obviously, when we walk around as sighted people, I don't think we really pay attention too much, consciously anyways, as to what we're looking at. Our brains are so good at kind of calculating things on the fly. For example, if you're walking down the sidewalk and there's like a step down or a step up or something like that, you don't consciously think like, okay, I got to raise my foot, you know, half a foot here to get over this thing or anything like that. You're not thinking about that. Or if there's like something overhead, you immediately just, you kind of unconsciously duck under it. You don't think about that at all. But when you, obviously when you're blind, you can't see any of this stuff, right? So when you're walking with a sighted person, it's the responsibility of the sighted person to pay attention to all this and let the blind person know what's coming up ahead. You have to let them know in five steps, there's going to be a step up, and the step up is a certain height. And how many steps, or you know, how far is it down? Is there a little gap in the sidewalk? Is there a little hole or something she could, you know, he or she could put their foot into? Is there something that could hit them in the head or whatever? Like, it's just amazing how much you have to suddenly pay attention to that you just did subconsciously before. So I think it's a really great experience for anyone to do that. I don't know if it's possible. Like, I don't think you can just go walk up to a blind person and be like, hey, can I walk around with you? And I don't think there's like a rent a blind person website or anything like that. But I don't know like how you would organize that. But if it's possible to, like, there's some kind of association or whatever, like, blind people should organize like a walk around the city with blind people day or something like that, because, like, really, I honestly encourage everyone to try to do it, because it's a really great experience, and I think it gives you a greater appreciation of certain design cues that are built into the cities for disabled people. I think, like, you know, as someone who's not really disabled myself, I think it's easy for us to kind of dismiss a lot of these things as not really that serious or not really that needed. When we hear about like ramps being built for wheelchair people or braille signs or anything like that, it's easy for us to think, oh, that's kind of good for them. But we don't really have an appreciation of how convenient and how much it affects someone's life. So I think like walking around with someone who's got low vision will really make you appreciate all those small design cues that they need and they use to get around their city. And then if your city doesn't have those kind of things, then it makes you also feel like, hey, why don't we have this kind of stuff? So it's a really, I think it's a tremendous experience for everyone to try to do. And I know it certainly my friend in Bangkok taught me a lot about kind of how to pay attention to what's going on around you. But anyways, that wraps up this episode of the Tokyo Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm your host, Anthony Cho, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.